3.
For generations, the Statue of Liberty has stood in New York Harbor, beckoning the poor and the oppressed of other lands to America with the lamp of freedom. Untold millions have sacrificed, struggled, and courted death for the privilege of sailing past her to the Ellis Island Immigration Depot to begin new lives as Americans. In the past, as many as 5,000 immigrants in a single day have entered the United States at Ellis Island in the protective shadow of the Statue of Liberty. And for every single one of them, it was an experience never to be forgotten. But today, the Statue of Liberty at Ellis Island silently tell a different story. In September 1972, Ellis Island closed its doors to immigrants and is today a national monument to what used to be. While visitors absorb the silent echoes of a bygone era, Ellis Island waits for the moment when it will be demolished by a Soviet hydrogen bomb, which has already been planted in the dock area. Likewise, the Statue of Liberty now holds aloft not the lamp of freedom, but a torch of warning. Within the statue itself, another Soviet H-bomb now waits, ready to erase what for millions is the most precious of all symbols of national heritage, the Statue of Liberty. My friends, Soviet saboteurs have planted scores of nuclear mines in the metropolitan New York area, both in the water and on land, and they are still at it, still virtually unhampered. It has now been 9 months since I first revealed the Soviet program of nuclear sabotage in the United States, beginning with major Western dams and reservoirs. By last June 1977, Soviet nuclear saboteurs were overrunning our country without interference, except where Canadian authorities caught them north of our border on information relayed by me. As you know, I temporarily suspended recording the audio letter in an all-out effort to decisively expose and thereby stop the mushrooming Soviet sabotage before it was too late. After a silence of 3 months, I resumed the audio letter with issue 25 in August 1977. I told you what I had been trying to do with the cooperation of concerned citizens nationwide. I told you of the official inaction, unwillingness to investigate, and other factors that had defeated these efforts. And I alerted you of the great lengths to which the Soviet sabotage had already gone by then, such as the 158 nuclear mines lurking in the Mississippi River alone, like the one that destroyed the Continental Grain Company grain elevator near New Orleans 4 months later on December 22, 1977. Now, thanks to Soviet sabotage preparations, grain elevators and other important installations in the United States are exploding and burning with unprecedented frequency. So much so, in fact, that many of these occurrences are now being minimized and even embargoed in the major news media in order to keep the public as a whole from realizing what is taking place and losing confidence in authority. Meanwhile, the Soviet sabotage campaign has now been allowed to proceed so far that nuclear mines are no longer being placed exclusively as strategic targets. Many are now being planted also in non-strategic psychological targets with little or no direct military or economic importance. Thus, the Soviet Union is now preparing to engage in the world's first nuclear terrorism. To use New York City again as an example, according to my latest intelligence information, there are over 80 Soviet nuclear mines planted already in and around the five boroughs, 26 in the water, the rest upon land. Among the targets are Rockefeller Center, the Empire State Building, United Nations Headquarters, Columbia University, Fordham University, Bellevue Medical Center, Central Park Reservoir, and other public buildings. Mines also threaten the George Washington Bridge, all three legs of the Triborough Bridge, the Queensboro, Manhattan, and Brooklyn bridges, as well as other bridges. Railroad tracks and yards are mined, along with several subway stations and the rapid transit station at Yankee Stadium. The Holland and Brooklyn battery tunnels are mined. LaGuardia Airport is threatened by two landmines and a third nearby in Flushing Bay. There is a mine off Willets Point near the Fort Totten Military Reservation and one near the Naval Dry Dock at Bayonne, New Jersey. There is one in Long Island Sound near the United States Merchant Marine Academy and one near the Police Academy firing range on Rodman Neck. But sabotage is only one small part of the massive Soviet effort to get ready to make war on the world's proudest nation. For example, in a speech earlier this month, General Richard Ellis, the head of the United States Strategic Air Command, said, and I quote, "We are faced with serious concerns over the development and deployment of arms by the USSR. This momentum of growth over the last decade has not been limited to any one system, any one mission, or any one geographical area," unquote. To illustrate what he meant, General Ellis referred to the supersonic backfire bomber, the Soviet ballistic missile submarine fleet, the world's largest ICBM force, the huge Soviet civil defense program, the tremendous Soviet air defense system, the operational Soviet anti-satellite capability, and the huge and growing Soviet army with new equipment ready to fight nuclear, chemical, biological, or conventional warfare. General Ellis went on to call attention to the great increase in Soviet war training military exercises during the past year. Quote, "This series is the most extensive ever noted, and such activity is now becoming a routine feature of Soviet force and command tests. It reflects the expanse and sophistication of the momentum of Soviet military development," unquote. My friends, we often hear soothing words about how backward the Soviet Union is compared to the United States. This is true in the area of commercial goods, which is where we put most of our money and know-how. But when it comes to military and scientific development, it's a different story. We tend to forget that the Soviet Union began surprising us in military technology soon after World War II. In 1949, the USSR handed America a nasty surprise by exploding an atomic bomb years before they were expected to do so. Espionage and help from high places in government and industry played a major role in that surprise, but it still required technological capabilities that were very considerable indeed. Then came Korea and another surprise. Our flyers met it in the air. It was called the MiG-15 fighter. Over a year ago, I told the true story of the Sputnik 1 surprise. We could have beaten Russia, but we did not. In 1961, there was still another shocking surprise. At an air show in Moscow, a brand new supersonic twin-engine bomber of advanced design dumbfounded spectators from the West as it roared over their heads. It was unlike anything in the West, and until it flew over, our intelligence community did not even know it existed. Today, this bomber is still operational, and it's called the Blinder by NATO. And so it goes, my friends. By two decades ago, Soviet science and military technology were beginning to rival our own, and in some areas were even ahead. And as long as a decade ago, highly knowledgeable Americans who visited the Novosibirsk Science City were shaken by what they saw. Elaborate, up-to-the-minute facilities, prosperous surroundings, and a level of scientific expertise that was, quote, kind of scary, unquote, in the words of one such visitor. I've told you in the past how this all came about. It was built up artificially using massive transfusions of technology and economic aid from the West, primarily the United States. But the fact remains, it exists. And the Soviet Union is no longer under the thumb of those who brought about this transformation. The Soviet Union is now a great Frankenstein monster, and it's turning on its former masters, our secret rulers, to destroy them. And already, the Kremlin is making preparations to police a conquered world. Last month, I revealed that the Soviet Union had begun operational deployment of floating platforms over the United States and selected other areas worldwide. These platforms, which are not in orbit, are able to hover in a stationary position over any location they choose, as I explained last month. They are an advanced version of the hovering platforms some of our highest military leaders could see on the technical horizon over 15 years ago. Just as happened with Sputnik 1, the United States could have developed such platforms long before the Soviet Union, but did not. Now the Soviets have them, and we do not. The Soviet floating platform, armed as it is with particle beam weaponry, is called the anti-war machine by the Kremlin. By this, they are referring to the intended role of the platforms after the United States is destroyed by nuclear war in policing the world under Soviet domination. A small hint of what they can do has been provided recently by the mysterious airquakes along the east coast of the United States in the past 6 weeks. As I told you last month, these have been caused by defocused particle beam blasts at sea by Platform 1. In focused operation, these beams can even destroy American ICBMs in their silos. When I recorded audio letter 29 last month, there were 7 floating platforms over our country, 4 of them manned, the other 3 waiting for crews to arrive by electrogravitic shuttle. Today, the number over the lower 48 states has increased to 10, and they are all manned now, as are all the rest that are deployed worldwide. The 2 platforms, which last month were off the coasts of Southern California and South Carolina, moved inland early this month to respective positions roughly over Hoover Dam and over North Carolina, halfway between Fayetteville and Cape Fear. There also has been some shifting of position among the other platforms. As of tonight, all but 1 are south of the 40th parallel, which I revealed in May 1976 is the lower boundary of the super-secret nuclear safe zone. There is also a platform over southern Alaska, another over the ocean just west of Oahu, Hawaii, and a 3rd directly over the Panama Canal. 4 platforms are on stations over Latin America, 1 each over Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Bolivia. In Europe, NATO countries are wringing their hands over whether or not the Carter administration will let them have cruise missiles and neutron bombs for self-defense against the Warsaw Pact forces. But floating overhead now are a string of 3 Soviet platforms, 1 over France, the 2nd over Western Hungary, and the 3rd over Turkey. In the Middle East, on-again, off-again peace talks are alternating with accusations and name-calling. Meanwhile, hovering silently overhead at the northwest tip of Saudi Arabia is a Soviet platform able to strike Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Syria. In southern Africa, shouting over our apartheid and majority rule are going on under the eyes of 2 floating platforms, which can now strike targets in Rhodesia and South Africa at will. A 3rd platform is currently stationed over the northern border of Zaire, capable of knocking out the secret West German particle beam development installations in Shaba Province, Zaire. A platform is floating near Lahore, Pakistan. Another is over the west coast of India near Bombay. And when Jimmy Carter was just 800 miles away in Delhi early this month, It blasted an Air India Boeing 747 out of the sky, killing all 213 aboard. There are two platforms over Red China, one in the east, the other in the west, near the Lop Nur weapons installation. There is a platform over southern Japan, and lately, the Japanese are finding the Soviets unbending in negotiations. There's a platform between Indonesia and New Guinea, and there are three over Australia, one in the north, one in the southeast, and one in the west. Finally, there's a platform over the Arctic Ocean, northwest of Alaska, and two more over Russia itself for protective purposes. In the past few days, the platforms over the United States have started descending to very low altitudes, ranging from 15 to 60 miles. All the other platforms worldwide are remaining at their normal altitudes of several hundred miles, with one exception. The platform near Israel has descended tonight to an altitude of 50 miles. There has been no attempt to intercept any of these platforms. 1 week ago, the Soviet Union announced the launching of the first in a new series of spacecraft called Progress 1. Radio Moscow described it as a cargo craft of a new type, a sort of automatic space truck. But a better term would have been space bus. Far from being unmanned, as claimed, Progress 1 was launched with 9 cosmonauts aboard, and the link-up with Salyut 6 is only temporary. Progress 1 is to be the first component of a mammoth new space station to be constructed in space, like those the late Dr. Wernher von Braun foresaw 25 years ago. Few Americans paid much attention to Progress 1, but Americans and the world were rocked back on their heels just 4 days ago by an unpleasant new Soviet surprise. On that day, January 24, 1978, an early morning announcement in Washington said that a Soviet nuclear-powered satellite had crashed in northern Canada, and there were worries that it might have spread deadly radioactive contamination on the ground, in the air, or both. But over and over again, all day long, news reports assured us, in breathless terms, that there was nothing to get excited about. Even before United States and Canadian search teams were sent to start looking for the remnants of the satellite, National Security Council Chief Brzezinski said during his early morning press briefing, quote, "This is not a horror scenario. The chances of a real hazard are small," unquote. And yet he also said, "We were planning for the worst," unquote. The crashed Soviet satellite, known as Cosmos 954, was described by various reports in the news as a navigation satellite, an observation satellite, or simply a military satellite. Finally, the government released the official story that it was a spy satellite. So far, only the BBC has come close to the truth, calling it a raider satellite, quote-unquote, on January 25. All reports have described it as unmanned, but, my friends, it is manned. The story of the Cosmos killer satellite 954 began 4 months ago in September 1977. That month, in Audio Letter 26, I revealed that the Soviet Union already had 2 operational killer satellites in orbit and that they had been used. One, as I mentioned then, was Cosmos 929, launched 2 months earlier on July 17, 1977. The other was Cosmos 954, the satellite that crashed in Canada a few days ago. For my newer listeners, I should point out that in Audio Letter 26, I described in detail the newly operational Soviet killer satellites. That tape was recorded on September 30th, before the government made its first announcement about Soviet killer satellites on October 4, 1977. On that day, Secretary of Defense Harold Brown stunned reporters with a totally unexpected announcement during a press conference. He said that the Soviet Union now has an operational killer satellite capability which can destroy our spy satellites. Before Cosmos 954 was launched last September, Cosmos 929, the first of Russia's new fleet of Cosmos interceptors, was already in orbit, undergoing final checkout. Armed with charged particle beam weapons, these destroy target satellites by causing them to erupt into enormous fireballs, a rash of which were reported around the world for a while starting in late September. Cosmos 954 was also a killer satellite, similar to Cosmos 929, except in one respect. Cosmos 954 was armed with a neutron particle beam, and it was intended for a very special task. In September 1977, Cosmos 954 was launched from Tyuritam Cosmodrome in the Soviet Union. Cosmos 954 had been rushed into orbit on a crash program to put it into operation at the earliest possible moment. KGB agents at Diego Garcia, headquarters of then America's secretly continuing moon program, had informed the Kremlin that they would have to act fast. On September 26, 1977, Cosmos killer satellite 954 was ready. It began firing its neutron particle beam weapon at the moon, bombarding the American personnel in Copernicus crater with deadly neutron radiation, just like that produced by a neutron bomb. Through the night and into the next day, the bombardment continued, interrupted only when the Earth blocked Cosmos 954's line of sight to the moon. By late in the day of September 27, 1977, the last astronauts in Copernicus crater were dead. In a stunning upset, the United States of America had lost the most decisive battle of the 20th century, the Battle of the Harvest Moon. Cosmos 954 performed well and did its job in the Battle of the Harvest Moon. But whenever a particle beam weapon is fired, it produces a reaction that disturbs the orbit of the satellite from which it is fired. The Soviet Cosmos interceptors use auxiliary thrusters to correct for this effect. But those aboard Cosmos 954 did not perform perfectly during the Battle of the Harvest Moon, leaving the orbit still needing correction. When these corrections were attempted later, the thrusters malfunctioned, and despite repeated attempts by the crew of Cosmos 954 to find and correct the problem, they were unsuccessful. By early December, NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command, had detected the orbital troubles of Cosmos 954. A top-secret project, Operation Morning Light, was set in motion by the National Security Council to get ready for the crash of Cosmos 954 anywhere in the world and a possible nuclear disaster as a result of the crash. That is why, shortly before Christmas, reporters asking the Pentagon about a rumored new Soviet anti-satellite test got no answers. The National Security Council had clamped a lid on the story. On the morning of January 24, Cosmos 954 re-entered the atmosphere, streaking over Queen Charlotte Island and northern British Columbia to land in the far north of Canada. The crew capsule of Cosmos 954, with its power pack, was designed to survive re-entry, but other parts of the complex satellite were allowed to disintegrate in the atmosphere. As a result, eyewitnesses saw one main object followed by a trail of burning pieces. The main object, brighter and faster than the rest, was the crew capsule, its heat shield causing the air to be heated white hot. It landed safely, well to the north of Great Slave Lake, at coordinates 64, 47, 27 north, 115, 7, 30 west. That's about 160 miles north-northwest of Yellowknife and about 120 miles southeast of Port Radium in an unpopulated area. Cosmos 954 had lost the ability to restore its orbit, but the crew did still have sufficient reentry control to select a landing site not very different from one in the Soviet Union. Unlike American spacecraft, Soviet spaceships always return to land rather than splashing down the way we do. The crew have been in contact with Moscow awaiting rescue, And just as happened in October 1976, when their missile-planting mini-submarine became trapped in Chesapeake Bay, the Soviet Union has again been allowed to recover their stranded military craft without public exposure. A floating platform, previously stationed over Ottawa, Canada, picked up the crew and the space capsule this evening at about 7:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It is now on its way back toward Ottawa, its battle station. But while the world's eyes have been riveted on the drama in northern Canada, ominous developments have been taking place in the Atlantic, Pacific, and Gulf of Mexico. As I say these words, the Soviet Navy is once again forming a three-pronged pincer movement on the continental United States. The Atlantic Fleet is lined up over a front nearly 1,000 miles long from Connecticut to southern Florida, roughly 200 miles offshore at this very moment. The Pacific Fleet is about the same distance offshore, spread out over a distance of 900 miles from roughly the north tip of California southward. The Gulf Fleet is stretched out over a 750-mile front between the southern tips of Texas and Florida. This is happening at a time when unprecedented storms are ravaging the United States, especially in our industrial heartland of the Midwest. 11 months ago, in Audio Letter 21, I told you that the strange extreme storms that had just taken place were believed to be the result of a massive Soviet weather modification experiment. I gave a warning that a repetition of such extreme and unusual weather patterns that paralyzed important areas of our country might well precede a surprise attack by the Soviet Union. And at this very moment, tonight, our country is in the grip of extreme and totally unexpected winter storms which are paralyzing large areas from the Midwest to the Northeast. Even so, the government isn't about to tell you about the Soviet submarine fleets now deployed around our country. This is especially true now because the Soviet Navy is deployed in such a way as to strongly suggest to our desperate rulers that the Soviets are going to live up to the super-secret nuclear safe zone agreement which I revealed long ago in Audio Letter 12. And that's why, as Jimmy Carter and other top government officials converged on the war room at the Pentagon just today, the cover story given the public is that it is to view, quote, a simulated crisis situation, unquote. My friends, the Russians are now ready. They are ready to destroy America's military and economic resources at a single coordinated blow. They are ready to survive American retaliation, if any. And they're ready with their floating platforms deployed worldwide, plus their 8-particle beam installations on the moon, to begin policing a conquered world. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless and protect each and every one of you.